Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast. I'm Richard Lee, and this week we're exploring the mysteries of mazes. Or at least, we will be if I can only find my way. Left. Oh, watching out for the puddle. Around the corner. Oh, another puddle. Right, here we go. The leaves are still brown and wrinkled on the hornbeams in the Crystal Palace maze, but the hedges are still thick enough there's no question of squeezing through if you get lost. Somewhere in the middle, beyond all this mud, somewhere in the middle of this labyrinth is Henry Elliot, the author of A Study of Mazes and Their Meanings. Follow this thread. And here he is. Hello.
Richard, welcome.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thanks.
Oh, terrific. It's rather nice in the middle here, isn't it?
It's beautiful, yeah.
It's quite broad. Gracious. Oh, and there's a plan on the floor as well.
Yes, yeah, so you can retrace the steps you've just made.
Now, that could have been useful, couldn't it? Oh, we've even got a poem. Look, here. Pause here a while. Listen for the echoes. Past, present, future. Follow in their footsteps. So should we pause here a while and think about the past, the present and the future of mazes? They're old enough to go back into the mists of time, aren't they?
They are very ancient. One of the first symbols that humankind scratched into the rocks of caves was the labyrinth symbol. And we should maybe make the distinction between a labyrinth and a maze, which some people draw, which is that a labyrinth has no choices. You can't go wrong. It has one path that's tightly coiled into a small space and you follow it and reach the centre. Whereas a maze has dead ends, it has choices, and you can go wrong in it.
As we've just discovered, or I have at least. But perhaps the most famous labyrinth, or perhaps it was a maze, we're not entirely sure, of myth and legend was the one that Daedalus constructed.
Of course, on the Isle of Crete at Knossos. And this was the house that he made for this deadly creature, the Minotaur. And in the legend, of course, young Athenians were fed into it as a kind of tribute to feed this Minotaur. Now, it's always described as a labyrinth, but actually, it must have been a maze, because the whole point of that story is that people went in and couldn't get out, and the Minotaur, too, was trapped inside there. So it was somehow inextricable. And so, even though labyrinths are much older than mazes, the idea of a maze is extremely ancient. But in fact, the earliest maze that we have any definite record of is only about 600 years old. And it's a paper maze drawn in the notebook of this Venetian magus called Giovanni Fontana. And that is the earliest maze that is in existence.
Should we hear a little bit about it now?
Designing a maze requires an array of topological techniques. And for six centuries, we have been reassembling Daedalus's methods, recovering his hidden principles of maze-making. The earliest surviving maze is in the Bavarian Staatsbibliothek in Munich, in a book of early 15th century technical drawings by a Venetian magus called Giovanni Fontana. This remarkable volume, known as the Bellicorum Instrumentorum Liber, the Book of War Machines, is mostly filled with pictures of bizarre weapons, mechanical camels, exploding globes, fire cannon, rocket-propelled rabbits, and violent helter-skelters. On facing pages, Fontana includes two maze designs, one circular and one square. No earlier mazes are known to exist. In Fontana's commentary, he explains that he was inspired by Daedalus to draw these two-dimensional designs with laborious paths, dark, winding convolutions, terrors, loops, and lonely places. Given the number of aggressive contraptions that fill the book, he clearly envisaged them as traps, either defensive walls for protecting a citadel, or more likely, cruel dungeons for driving one's enemies insane.
So, the idea of labyrinths, these paths that you can follow through their convolutions and whirls, is very, very old. As you said, they're scratched on the side of caves, and thousands of years old indeed. But the idea of a maze where you can choose your path is very much more modern, only came to prominence in the Renaissance. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think in the classical world, there was an idea of the thread of your life, your life's thread that guided you through, and fate was something that was unwinding in front of you. And I think in the medieval Christian period in the West, there was a similar idea that God was controlling your life and really you could take any path, but that was where you were supposed to go. You were being led through life. And St. Augustine has this image of a Christian as a pilgrim being pulled through the labyrinth of life. But I think in the Renaissance, something changed. The rise of humanism meant that people took more control over their own life, and there was a sense that you could make choices, that you could change the path you were on. And of course, the danger with that realization is that you could make mistakes, you could go wrong, you could hit a dead end, you could take a longer path than you should have done. And conversely, of course, you could make good decisions. And so I think that's perhaps why at this moment there was suddenly a flourishing of mazes as opposed to labyrinths. One of the first ways in which mazes manifested themselves were in the grounds of great stately homes and castles, especially in France and northern Italy. And perhaps the most iconic of the early hedge mazes was the maze at Versailles, the Labyrinth of Versailles, which was really quite a simple maze in terms of its design. It was one huge kind of field of bush with paths carved through it. So it was a bit unlike what you might imagine a hedge maze is like today, which is quite tightly packed in. There were lots of spaces of dense foliage with these paths curved through. And it was partly designed by Charles Perrault, the writer of fables. And he advised at every kind of juncture where you might stop a while to kind of wonder what to do, he advised on putting a little statue there just to kind of break up the scene. And it might have been helpful as well to kind of remind you when you'd been somewhere before and to spot when you were going round in circles. And this labyrinth really became iconic and was a real example of, you know, conspicuous consumption. This was a really luxurious use of land. You know, there's very little functional use to a maze. It's a status symbol that shows what kind of how much money you can spend on a luxurious object.
And this idea spread throughout Europe.
That's right. Yeah, quickly other houses started installing these things. Some contemporary English gardeners so admired the Labyrinth of Versailles that they built one at Hampton Court, which is the oldest hedge maze in Britain. And for several centuries, really, mazes were the sole purview of wealthy landowners.
In fact, Versailles, the gardens at Versailles, was one of the inspirations for Joseph Paxton, who designed the maze here at Crystal Palace.
Absolutely, yeah. Paxton very much admired the gardens at Versailles. And so when he came to design this park around the repositioned Crystal Palace, it must have seemed appropriate to put in a maze. I think when it was first installed in the late 1860s, it was called the Great Maze, and then it's had other names over the years. It was called the Tea Maze at one point, maybe because, you know, when people had their tea up at the palace, they could have a little wander around it. And it remains here as a sort of relic of Paxton's vision, because, of course, the palace, very sadly, has burnt down and is no longer there. It's rather poignant.
It burnt down in the 1930s, didn't it? But this maze also fell into disrepair at that stage, didn't it? But has been redeveloped since.
Yes, there was a great kind of lull in interest in mazes in the early 20th century, and many mazes fell into disrepair, and this was no exception. And it was really in the 90s that it was properly renovated, and even then it fell into a little bit of disrepair, and it was in 2009 that it was substantially restored by the Girl Guides Association, in fact, because that was their 100th centenary, and they began by sneaking into some Boys Scout activity in Crystal Palace Park in 1909. So to celebrate the centenary of the beginnings of Girl Guides, they've restored this maze.
It's become part of the modern surge for mazes. I mean, should we go and find some more modern mazes?
Let's go.
Here on the Victoria Line platform at Warren Street, there's a set of mazes designed by Alan Fletcher behind these benches. So just describe it for us, Henry.
Yeah, so this is a maze made out of tiles set behind one of the wooden benches on the platform. And now, Alan was a very sneaky designer, and he worked out that the average wait between trains on this platform was around about 3 minutes.
And so we've got one due in 1 minute after ours, in fact.
Yes, they've got to speed it up since 1967. And so he designed this maze to take about 4 minutes to solve, just longer than that average wait, to frustrate commuters on the platform.
There's nobody here cursing as the train leaves today. It's a rather beautiful thing in red and black, with the black as the perspective going down and the white of the clear path beneath.
Yeah, it's beautifully graphic, isn't it? I mean, it fits in well with the, you know, the ethos of TfL, these like really strong graphic colours. Should we try and solve it?
Let's go.
So,
we're starting at the top, are we?
Exactly.
Yeah.
We'll work out where to go in, which is at the top.
And then I suppose the thing which takes the time is actually trace it. I think you will have to trace it with a finger, otherwise it would be too quick. And I can hear a train coming. This is getting a bit close. No, this is no good. Go back. Oh, I'm getting closer.
Tell you what, it's a little noisy down here. Should we make our way through the maze of tunnels up onto the street and
Let's
talk
go.
Some more?
Yes. So we've just emerged out of Warren Street Station onto Warren Street itself. And there's actually another little maze around the corner if you'd like to
Let's
see
go
it.
Check it out. Okay. It's set in the pavement with bricks of red and black.
Yes, and at first glance, it looks a little bit like a labyrinth. It's quite similar to some of the labyrinth designs you get in the great Gothic cathedrals of northern France. But actually, when you start looking, you can see there are some junctions, there are some choices. So this is a maze, not a labyrinth.
It looks like a bit of public art, a redesign of this. There's a small football pitch here and some swings and slides. And as part of that development, a maze has been put in. According to the maze designer Adam Fisher, we're living in the greatest golden age of mazes. So when did this golden age begin?
Well, I think it really began in the 60s with an artist called Michael Ayrton, who was the first person to really enthuse people about the myth of Theseus and the Minotaur. And then the absolute turning point was in the mid-70s when this extraordinary character called Greg Bright, who called himself the Maze King, he had dug a trench maze at Pilton Farm, the site of the Glastonbury Festival, and the Marquess of Bath saw this maze and commissioned Greg to build a vast hedge maze at his ancestral home, Longleat House, which is still the largest maze in Britain, and for a long time it was the largest one in the world. And this was a really strange thing to do. It was an extremely expensive project, and there was no evidence that it was going to make its money back. But in fact, it turned out to be a huge success, a real commercial visitor attraction. And almost immediately, a huge number of other maze designers began putting mazes up around Britain and the world. And it was in the late 70s that the maze maker Adrian Fisher appeared on the scene. He co-founded with an ex-diplomat, Randall Coate, who was actually a friend of the writer Borges. They've co-founded a company called Minotaur Designs, the first company which was devoted to building and designing mazes. And Adrian, since then, has gone from strength to strength. He's built something like 700 mazes over the years in many, many different countries around the world. He's built hedge mazes, tile mazes. He's pioneered the new form of maize mazes, where a farmer will give over a field for the summer and the corn is cut into the design of a maze, and it lasts for, you know, a few months and then it dies. And so Adrian is the most prolific maze maker that the world has ever seen, and there are more mazes in the world today than ever before in the history of the world.
There's something of a tension between Fisher's vision of the maze as a kind of leisure opportunity and Bright's more mystical approach.
Yes, I do see that. I mean, I've met both Greg Bright and Adrian Fisher. Adrian is a businessman. I mean, he works with clients. He's very interested in suiting the maze to the environment, to the owner, and ensuring that it's a fun family activity to enjoy. Greg Bright's interest was much more in the mathematics of mazes and in the different ways that you can put roots into a compact space. And he was very interested in the ways that you could manipulate a walker inside one of his mazes. And his mazes grew more and more complicated, especially the ones he drew on paper.
You say was. Is he no longer building mazes?
He is no longer building mazes. I don't know how far this is true, but he says that he fell out of love with them at the end of the 70s. And I hear that he was receiving offers, very lucrative offers, to make mazes in all sorts of places, but he felt like he was being pulled towards, I guess, the more Adrian Fisher end of the spectrum, the kind of fun and games element, and which he rejected. And so he kind of turned his back on mazes, where he had been this maze king character with a solo show of maze designs at the ICA in London.
It's odd to think of something as timeless as a maze as actually being a technology that in some sense can be invented or reinvented or improved. But there's a story of gradually accelerating development as well as mazes appearing all over the world.
That's absolutely right. Mazes vary in how complicated they are, and there are various tricks that a maze maker can put into a maze to make it difficult. I suppose the first and most obvious one is size. I mean, the larger a maze is, the harder it is to crack, simply because you're multiplying the number of choices and so on. Then in the 1820s, there was a huge breakthrough, which was made by Earl Stanhope of Cheveningham House in Kent. And before that point, the paths of mazes had all been connected together. So even if they were extremely complex with lots of choices, if you walked every path, you would eventually reach the centre. And a way of doing this is known as the hand-on-wall method. You imagine keeping your left or right hand on the left or right hand wall, and walk round, never breaking contact with the wall. And if everything is connected, you'll eventually get to the centre. It can take quite a long time. But Earl Stanhope had this brilliant idea, which was to disconnect sections of the maze, and crucially, to disconnect the section of the maze which contained the goal at the centre. And what that meant was that if you were trying this hand-on-wall method, you'd reach the entrance again before you'd ever got to the centre. So that was the first recent innovation. And then Greg Bright really pioneered the more recent developments. The first one he invented was something he called mutually accessible centres. Now, these are points in the maze where discrete sections interconnect. And Greg's aim with this was to keep the whole maze alive at any one time. So there was no possibility of kind of working out that bit of the maze was wrong and you could carry on to the rest. Everything was connected as if it was on a grid or a network, which meant there was a possibility of circling back to areas you'd already been in, of possibly getting quite close to the goal and then circling right back to the beginning. And it makes the maze much harder and much more infuriating. The next innovation he came up with, he called partial valves. And these were ways of manipulating what he called the tides of movement within a maze. And essentially, they look very beautiful, actually, in his designs. They're like huge spirals with maybe 5 or 7 paths whirling around each other to a central clearing in the middle of this spiral. And the idea is that a walker will come through one of these paths into the centre. They're then faced with a number of choices, and they choose one and carry on. And the point is, if they try to retrace their steps, when they get to that central point, it's very hard to remember which path they originally entered from. And so you're making it harder for them to retrace their steps past that point, a bit like a valve in a plumbing system. And the final device that Greg introduced at his maze at Longleat is the device of bridges. Now, bridges literally add a new dimension to a maze, because if you don't have a bridge, then gradually the paths you've already planned out will limit what you can do with the rest of the design. And for instance, if you know, as we did in the Crystal Palace Park maze, that there's a exit from the centre to the outside, you know that that can't be broken. And so if you know that the entrance to the centre is from the other side of that path, you're going to have to go all the way around the maze somehow to get to it. If there are bridges, you don't have that clue, because at any point you can slip over one of the other paths, and it gives the maze maker many more options for making the maze complex. In fact, Greg wanted to have underpasses at Longleat rather than bridges, so that the path would invisibly duck underneath another one, because he felt like bridges were giving too much of a clue. They were kind of visual landmarks you could use, but it turned out it was so expensive already they couldn't stretch to underpasses.
There's actually a labyrinth just round the corner here, back at the tube station, and in fact, at every tube station all over London, that goes back to a more ancient template.
That's right. The artist Mark Wallinger was commissioned to celebrate the 150th anniversary of the tube network, and what he did was put a labyrinth into every single station, all 270. And he's done an incredible job of getting a different design of labyrinth in every single one. And what he says about them is he sees each labyrinth as a mental map, a representation of the orientation and contemplation which are the everyday experience of millions of Londoners and their days spent on the labyrinthine network.
Let's dive into it now.
Mind the gap between the train and the platform.
This is Barbican.
For some, the quest inherent in a city is the challenge first to recognise and then to transcend its maze-like qualities. The Situationists believed that Paris's thoroughfares, advertisements, signs and maps were forcing citizens to conform to a capitalist norm. Led by Guy Debord in the 1960s, they championed the concept of the derive, ignoring a city's subliminal routing and drifting instead against the prevailing tides of movement. Simultaneously, a collective of Parisian writers replicated the Situationists' quest through literary games. Calling themselves Oulipo, short for Ouvroir de Littérature Potentielle, Studio for Potential Literature, writers such as Raymond Queneau and Georges Perec began constructing artificial constraints for their writing. Perec's 320-page novel La Disparition, for example, is a thriller in which a figure called Anton Vaul has disappeared. What's really missing, however, is the letter E. Perec wrote the entire novel without using it once. The British critic Philip Howard, also avoiding the letter E, described La Disparition as a story chock full of plots and subplots, of loops within loops, of trails in pursuit of trails, all of which allow its author an opportunity to display his customary virtuosity as an avant-gardist magician, acrobat, and clown. Queneau called his fellow Oulipians rats, who build the labyrinth from which they try to escape.
The city is itself something of a maze, or a series of mazes within mazes, and we're right at the heart of the city, right at the heart of that maze here, just by the Barbican Centre. And what have we got here in front of us, Henry?
Well, in many ways, we've reached the end of our journey here, because we're standing face to face with a tall and fearsome sculpture of a Minotaur. This is a half-human body. He's leaning on his left knee. His right arm is pulled back. He's just forming a fist with his right hand, and there's huge kind of power and energy in the muscles of that arm. He's got a pair of broad shoulders, and on top of those, hunched forward, is an enormous head of a bull with two really sharp-looking horns, some wicked eyes, and a muzzle that looks like it's about to snort steam at us.
He's ready to charge, isn't he?
He absolutely is. He's about to pounce and grapple us. And this is a sculpture by an artist called Michael Ayrton, who visited Cumae in Italy in 1956. Now, Cumae is a spot where Daedalus is supposed to have landed after he saw Icarus fall out of the sky. And Ayrton became obsessed by this myth of the master craftsman Daedalus. He describes himself as being godstruck by this myth, and he later visited Knossos on Crete, and throughout the 60s this myth of Daedalus and the Minotaur features more and more in his work, in his prints, his sculptures, and in his writing as well. And it's interesting to me that whenever Theseus appears in Ayrton's work, he comes across as a thug, as a brainless thug, really, whereas the Minotaur is treated much more compassionately. And I feel like that's not unusual. Another artist who was obsessed by the Minotaur was Picasso, and he has Minotaurs in many different situations, but it's often a very pitiful situation. It's often being slaughtered in front of a sort of dispassionate crowd, or he's looking lonely, or in some ways isolated. And another of my favourite artistic renderings of the Minotaur is the portrait by G.F. Watts, which is in the Tate collection, which apparently Watts painted to show the sort of bestial aspect of this monster. But when you look at it, there's something incredibly poignant about it. He's leaning on the parapet of the labyrinth, looking out over the sea, dreaming of freedom, we imagine. And it's very hard not to see it and feel sympathetic towards this creature. And it's interesting to me that artists are drawn to the Minotaur at the centre of this myth and have this kind of sympathetic reaction to him.
So it's that, perhaps it's that combination of the power, the strength, the threat that we're standing in front of here, and yet something more reflective.
Yes, that's exactly what Ayrton thought, that this was the only weakness the Minotaur had, that it had the power and strength of a bull, but it had the vestiges of human intelligence, and that little bit of humanity inside it meant that it second-guessed its animal reflexes, and so that was actually a weakness in its physical makeup.
Here, in front of the Minotaur, right at the centre of the city's maze, we're at a place of transformation, a place where anything could happen, in a sense. But there are many meanings which have been put onto labyrinths and mazes throughout history.
Yes, I think that's what I find most fascinating about mazes, actually. The different ways in which we use them to think about aspects of what it means to be human. And we often use them in very contradictory ways. So the most extreme example is that in many cultures, the maze is a symbol of death. So I'm thinking here of, you know, of the myth of Theseus and the Minotaur. The labyrinth is a place of sacrifice. It's a place of death, which amazingly Theseus manages to emerge from. But, you know, in the Polynesian islands, in the Vanuatu tradition, there's a maze on the way to the land of the dead. And in Celtic tradition, actually, many Celtic long barrows have stones associated with them with strange maze figures on them. And it's believed that those long barrows were known as spiral castles, which evokes the idea of a labyrinth. But then on the flip side, many cultures around the world see mazes as symbols of birth or rebirth. So in India, for instance, mothers going into labour are given, well, some of them are given, plates with labyrinths drawn onto them with spices, and then they drink that down with saffron water. And the idea is that this labyrinth will aid the unborn baby to find its way out into the world. And in traditions of North America, the same labyrinth symbol is used as a symbol of this concept of emergence, of spiritual rebirth from one state of being to another. And I find that fascinating, that you get that duality in the metaphors that we use for mazes. I mean, another one is that often when we approach a maze, we approach it in the spirit of a quest. It feels like a puzzle to crack, something to a goal to achieve, and we pit ourselves against the maze and against the maze maker. But another way of approaching a maze or a labyrinth is in a spirit of contemplation, and it's more of a meditative activity, even a spiritual one. And that's, I think, what's so interesting about this symbol, that it can be used in such a paradoxical way, and it's also a symbol that we can physically enter, we can bodily step inside this metaphor and think about these different meanings that it carries.
For Christians, it was a place not only where you could get lost, but also where you could be found.
Yes, that's right. So the labyrinth was adopted by Christianity back in kind of Roman Christian times, and then it was particularly in the High Middle Ages that labyrinths were incorporated into the pavement design in many of the great cathedrals of northern France and northern Italy especially. And when Christianity adopted the labyrinth, there were two specific changes they made to it. The first was to increase the number of paths from 7 to 11. And that's because, in St. Augustine's view, 11 was a particularly sinful number, because it wasn't quite the number of disciples, and it was one more than the number of commandments. And so this 11-path labyrinth came to represent the world of sin that we were all mired in as we were walking inside it. And sometimes when you're walking a big labyrinth, it can feel like you're stuck in it, because you're going on forever and ever. The other way in which Christianity adapted the symbol was to impose the cross onto it, so that a Christian labyrinth will usually split into four segments divided by the cross. But the other way in which you can be found through it is another way in which St. Augustine talked about labyrinths. And he pointed out that Christ had described himself as the way, and he had this image of Christ leading faithful pilgrims through the world of sin, pulling them along by a thread, in much the same way that Ariadne helped Theseus out of the labyrinth. But the kind of metaphor is that if you put your faith in God when you're in this difficult labyrinth, you'll eventually reach the centre and reach salvation there.
The stories of mazes, the stories of labyrinths are as ancient as humanity, but they've inspired modern writers as well.
They absolutely have. I think we use them all the time in our stories and in our literature. I mean, we're at the centre of a city now, and cities are often described in labyrinthine terms. I think of Thomas de Quincey walking through London, or a book like Dickens' Bleak House, where London becomes very labyrinthine. Victor Hugo in Les Miserables, he explicitly describes the city of Paris as a kind of palimpsest of different labyrinths. But perhaps the writer who has adopted labyrinths most fully is the blind Argentinian librarian, Jorge Luis Borges, whose short stories approach labyrinths from all kinds of different directions. And I really feel like Borges has done the best thinking that's ever been done about this metaphor and the ways we can use it. I mean, one of his most famous stories, The Library of Babel, imagines the universe as one enormous, coherent labyrinth of rooms filled with books. And there are these kind of adventurous traveller librarians trudging through this endless library, trying to find the great circular book which will explain the mysteries of this maze-like universe. There's another story where he describes the most terrifying kind of maze, which is a desert with literally not even any walls to walk around. You're lost wherever you are. There's no possibility of finding a way out. But perhaps my favourite story of his is a story called The House of Asterion, where he imagines himself into the mind of the Minotaur, whose real name was Asterion, and imagines what it must have been like to be trapped inside a labyrinth, to have these regular irritating invasions by these poor sacrificial Athenians, longing for someone to save them from this horrific prison. And so it's rather moving, actually, to be here in front of this half-human sculpture of a Minotaur, thinking of the way Borges thought himself inside that head, and yet here the Minotaur still is stuck in the middle of this huge labyrinthine city. On Michael Ayrton's gravestone in Hadstock Churchyard in Essex, his epitaph is a three-dimensional replica of his maze at Arkville. Within the great maze of a man's life are many smaller ones, each seemingly complete in itself, Michael Ayrton wrote in The Mazemaker. And in passing through each one, he dies in part, for in each he leaves behind him a part of his life, and it lies dead behind him. It is a paradox of the labyrinth that its centre appears to be the way to freedom.
That was Henry Elliott. Follow This Thread, complete with illustrations from Keeb, is published in a head-spinning edition by Particular Books. Next week, we'll be heading for the magical island of Aiaia with Madeline Miller's Circe. In the meantime, you can join in the discussion on Twitter at Guardian Books or on the Guardian website. Just search for Guardian Books Podcast, which is also how you'll find us in your favourite podcast app. For now, from me, Richard Lee, and our producer, Susanna Tresillian, thanks for listening and goodbye.